Herzlich willkommen bei Business for Future, dem Podcast für zukunftsorientiertes Wirtschaften. Wir wollen gemeinsam mit euch herausfinden, wie Menschen und Organisationen Verantwortung für gesellschaftliche Herausforderungen übernehmen können.
Und wir zeigen konkrete Beispiele, wie wir mit einer verantwortungsvollen Wirtschaft Zukunft gestalten können. Dafür sprechen wir mit Menschen, die den Mut haben, Dinge in Frage zu stellen, über spannende Visionen und verrückte Alternativen.
Wir sind Hanna Rauterberg und
Franziska Schölmerich.
Und wir freuen uns, dass ihr dabei seid. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
Today's episode is the first one in English. It is about using design to promote sustainable behavior in cities. We are talking about how the design of a city influences the behavior of the people living in a city and how cities can be designed in a way that invites people to choose the sustainable option. We discuss what organizations can learn from experiences in urban development and how the current pandemic has changed people's needs and the way they move within a city. So, Hanna, who is our guest for this episode?
Today we are talking to Lieselott Stenfeld. Lieselott, you're Director for Innovation at GEAL, a human-centered urban consulting company based in Copenhagen, New York, and San Francisco. Your focus is to create better cities for people and to create beneficial relationships between quality of life and their built environment.
Welcome, Lieselott. We always start with the question, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing great. It's a bit cold still. I was hoping March would be more warm and more the feeling of spring, but I guess it's coming in next week or something.
So you work at this interesting company called GEAL. Can you, for a start, tell us a bit more about the history and also the mission of GEAL?
Yes, of course. GEAL is a company that actually was founded 20 years ago by urban designer Helle Søholt and also Professor Jan GEAL. And when that was founded, it was actually based on Jan GEAL's research that he had been doing for many years before that. It actually goes all the way back to 1971, where he gave out the first book, Life Between Buildings. It's building very much or focusing on this relationship between the built environment and how people's quality of life is. So how they're actually thriving in a city in order to create more livable spaces that are very nice for people to be in.
One of the central aspects of your work is studying public life. So what exactly does this mean?
Just to say at first, like the way we see cities, we see it as a living system. It's ever changing. It's always evolving because it's people that makes a city. You could say it's like almost a human body that all the subsystems need to work together in order to work healthy. It's more or less the same with the city. You have all these subsystems in a city. You have buildings, mobility, products, services, and they need to conjunctions together. So when we say study public life, we refer to a history and range of research that is actually seeking how the built environment in all its different states actually influence people's individual behavior. And since public spaces are human-made, we also have the responsibility to become better in asking the right question, to look at the right things, to use the right methods to actually do this in a very sustainable way.
What I understood is that when GEAL was founded, it was really sort of revolutionary because you started from the human needs and not from what was common when designing a city. So probably you can tell us a bit more about this. Why was it so revolutionary and how can you probably still see this today at GEAL and how can you also apply it to other fields where it's not yet that common to really start with a human need?
Well, when you look more on eye level, you're very much looking at the persons living in the city, the individuals living in the city. And when you do that, you kind of start where the most important part of a city is. That is us as people. So for us, it's natural to work on this scale in order to actually then scale up. So you can say, well, if this works here for this individual in this age group, maybe it could work here too. And when we then start to look into that, sometimes we can and sometimes we realize that it takes a lot of cultural understanding working across the world and working with cities because we're looking at people's behavior. So it's a very good way to actually break down things that in traditional urban planning, it's more about infrastructure and big elements, big volumes, and it's more maybe about a shape that creates a fantastic space, but it's not the same as it creates a livable and thriving space. So this is the life between the building we're talking about, is this eye level approach to how people use the city.
So just to get it clear, the difference is that you start with a detail and then get it broader or try to find out what's the pattern behind, whereas others start with a bigger picture and then probably even forget to dig deeper and understand the details.
Yeah, often the money disappears before you get to the detail. So I guess you can say it's a more ethnographic approach, I would say, where you actually are more interested in, or just as interested in, how people are actually acting and interacting with each other in the social meeting.
And has there been a change in those human needs? If you look at the past 20 years, from my understanding, what you look at is, for example, social needs for belonging, inclusion, also democratic, establishing democratic structures, maybe also some ecological perspective. Has there been a change, or were those needs the same that were important 20 years ago?
Well, there are some needs, like, for example, the need to see other people, or like, I know Jan Gehl said it once, where people are people want to be. That's like a humanistic, very a belonging we all have. That will hopefully always be there. But what I think has changed is actually that technology has come into every people's everyday life. So we're now using iPhones, we're using all kind of technology to get around in cities, which in many ways can also take focus away from what you're seeing, the surroundings, and the way we interact with each other has in many ways moved over to social media. So when we're talking about the democratic space, for example, there's actually a lot of things happening on social media that in the older days would happen in the physical space. So there are absolutely some things that have moved. And looking at COVID in the last year, there have for sure been things moved into digital space, which of course is lovely to see because we didn't have any options. We couldn't go out the same way. We were more quarantined, all of us. But of course it has changed like how the social interaction in public space actually is played out. So yes, this has been very interesting to see how the looking at each other is not the same, for example, like when you pass each other, you don't have the same eye contact. It doesn't mean the same, for example, or it's very interesting in that way.
And so what I understood is that you also try to strengthen circular economy through designing cities. How does that work?
Well, you could say circular economy is something that, of course, has been on its way for a while. It's a very interesting area. And circular economy has very much focus on this optimizing the use of resources. And of course, we're all in the same situation all across the world. We have used up very many of the nature's resources. I think there was a research coming out just 3 days ago where it showed that we have used, I think, half of all the resources now in the world. So we have to optimize how we use it. So it's focusing very much on how we can better reuse materials and how we can better see some value in what already exists. This has so far been very connected to material use and very much on reusing plastic in new products or so on. We all know it from organizing waste, for example. But what we are very interested in, how we can actually develop and use these circular models, but in a city, more on city level, because when we do that, you can actually reduce the CO2 very much by actually going in and changing people's behavior more. Instead of looking very materialistic on things, you can strive to say, hey, what about if we talk about behavior and how you actually use things? And when looking at cities, I mean, it's a central, very, very central part of our global economy, right? We have to look at cities because over half of the world's population live in cities. So we can't really look away from that fact that we have to do something in the cities. So to us, going back to this kind of the city as a living organism or a body, for us, it's very important to say it's very complex. It's buildings, mobility, products, services, food system. It's all going together in order to create this circular economy. So it's not only like using plastic or not using plastic for us. It's about getting all of these systems to be subsystem in the living organism that a city is. So this is where transformation has to start, because it starts with us. It starts with us choosing more sustainable product. It starts with us choosing a more sustainable mobility options.
Can you tell us an example where you really could change people's behavior within a city by designing their surrounding in a certain way?
Yeah, so we have been working actually with this approach without calling it circular economy for many years, I realize. Some of the projects that we have been working on is actually very focused on changing people's mobility habits. One of the things I think Gael is quite known for is being a part of this transformation of mobility habits in Copenhagen. What we tried to do there was actually to look at people's behavior and then to try to design for encouraging people to make the sustainable choice the easy choice. So how can you actually make it easy for people to choose sustainable and healthy? And this was the approach we had when we started working with the city of Copenhagen, that wanted the green agenda to cut down CO2, and they wanted to support a healthier lifestyle at the citizens.
What's one thing that makes people choose the bike instead of something else?
What we did was actually we have made the bike lanes much wider, which means that more people can actually, in all Copenhagen, which means more can actually go there at the same time. And then Copenhagen has been really good to inform people about you can actually get to work this much faster by taking the bike. That has been a tremendous difference for people, that taking my bike can make me get there so much faster. The information is one thing, and also like the physical infrastructure that more people can actually go with it. So that also, of course, affects that cars can't drive as fast because that was taken from the car lanes. So it is a prioritization from the city. And of course, there's probably some car owners that are quite annoyed with it. But it has become this kind of big part of a Copenhagen lifestyle. I think 70% are actually commuting with bike in Copenhagen today and not with cars.
And I think this approach of making sustainable behavior just easier and more comfortable is so, I think it's really genius, so impactful, right? I've been to Copenhagen 2 years ago for 2 weeks, and so I could also experience this. Like being faster, it's really enjoyable taking the bike. It also feels super safe, right? Because you're guided really well. And then you have also those trash things who are bent towards the bikers, right? So you can throw your trash into it while biking. It's even a bit like nudging, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's very much, we like to call it inviting, because for some people nudging can sound a bit negative, but to invite people to actually do something is one of the best thing with designing, I think. And this could be very interesting for a lot of different industries. I think all companies should really focus on how you can invite for more sustainable behavior. I think it's such an important takeaway. It doesn't need to be a big, huge company to do this. You can do this on all different scales. So I think it's a very important part. And then also one of the things when we did this bike project also in other cities is to understand there is governance and there's users and there is the providers or the bike owners. And I think this is also very, very important to understand that these need to go together. The reason why it works in Copenhagen is because the city is supporting it and they're being bold and they're saying, let's do this. It's okay if the car owners get angry. We're going to do this. And you have like the citizens that are happy about it, most of them, because they're getting faster to work or school. And then you have like the bike owners that are actually good in collaborating with other companies putting up this garbage bin that you can throw into, or there's like these stations that show your number 56 today, which also encourage that you're a part of something bigger. And this all go together.
Where are your clients most of the time?
Well, traditionally, it has been the cities. We have worked with over 250 cities around the world, and we are still working with more and more. Traditionally, that has been it, but the last 3-4 years, we are collaborating much, much more with private companies, both bigger companies that realizes that they actually could make a difference in the city, like huge companies that move their whole industry to some small city. They actually do have a responsibility to offer something for the citizen that will work at their place and so on. And luckily, this is really happening, actually, especially in Germany. There's a lot of companies in Germany that comes to us and say, how can we make something good for the cities? And that's so very many bigger companies and then smaller that we go to in collaboration with.
When I think of Berlin, I mean, there has been a bit of change happening, especially in the past year. There have been some pop-up bike lanes and some streets that were temporarily closed for cars and things like this. But overall, I would say the city is not very inviting for riding a bike or inviting for sustainable behavior. So from your experience, what are the biggest points that hinder cities to create the cities more inviting for sustainable behavior?
Well, if you look at circular economy and if you look at also sustainable behavior, which for us go together, there's so many levels of innovation needed for it to happen in both like civic, both at the cities and also at the design, like design company, the role of design, the responsibility to design for sustainable behavior, the designers, or is it the cities, or is it actually the citizens to ask for this demand? I think it's very, very, very complex question, because this is one of the biggest reason why it takes so long time. Because who should take the risk and who should put the money on the table? I mean, the citizens are indirectly paying it if it's the cities. Are the cities ready to take the risk to change the way you develop thing? That takes a very bold city, to be honest, to stand up and say, this is what we're going to do. So I think like this kind of designing for new traditions has to come like both bottom up and top down, sort of. There has to be some visions. There has to be like something coming from bottom up, but it also has to be taken seriously from a top down decision maker.
What could be a nice way of collaboration between cities and business as well? Because I think when we had one of our first talks, you also told me that due to Corona, a lot of offices are empty right now. So it might also be an interest of bigger companies to find new solutions of how to integrate the space into the city and find another way of working together with the public space and using office space could be a cool, sustainable solution that is interesting for all of the stakeholders.
For me, there is the biggest potential to actually roll out circular economy models right now that are truly going to change something. And that is because when you look at statistics from the US right now, I think in the 10 largest cities in the States, the office space, as they're at 25% of total capacity today. So that's 25% being used of all the space they have. It's crazy when you think about it. And the same goes for a lot of countries. Like it's Denmark too. People are working from home. This asks questions like, could we actually design spaces that are more tailored to the type of job we're doing? Like instead of saying this whole company needs to have this space, how could we actually go into cities and say, like, how do we design for daily short meetings or like smaller hybrid places where you want to get inspired, or project pop-ups or sprints? Do you have like a third place for that? Or do you have something that is more for strategy meetings, like deep work? Why couldn't we share something between education and workspace and restaurants? And like, why can we not challenge how we use all of these buildings instead of building new? That's crazy. I mean, there's so many empty spaces at the moment. And I would say they could adapt to very many functions if we just focus on, again, this kind of human-centered approach and try to be like, how are people going to work from now on? It has changed. We don't have to discuss whether it's going to change. It has changed. And in many ways, that's good too, because it's also supporting a more sustainable living. If people don't travel as much or commute as much, just staying home 2 days a week is going to save the environment. Something on that budget and not taking a plane to have a meeting. Great.
When you look back to the last 12 months or so, what are the central results of your study of public life during the pandemic?
When you work for a company that has studied public life for so many years, COVID was this kind of unique opportunity to understand public life and people's behavior in its very basic form. Like, what is important for people when nothing is working? When all the shops are closed, the restaurants are closed, what is important to you? It has been so interesting for us as a company to actually look both in San Francisco, London, Copenhagen, Tirana, Tel Aviv. We have been looking at very many cities and to see that there are for sure some things that go through all of them. And one of the things is actually that it's very clear for us that the future is local. The future is going to be local. People have a newfound love for their neighborhood. When we asked people, over 60% of the citizens said that they were starting to have a value to different offerings in their local area in a totally new way than they ever had before. And the same people said they don't have a reason to go to the city center anymore because they found out they could just do it in their local neighborhoods. And they also have more of an ownership to the local neighborhoods. And there's a momentum to say, how can we support this tendency moving forward? How can we actually design for decentralization in our cities? That also includes working in the local areas. Maybe companies should consider how they can support this in local areas. Can you actually start to think about a decentralized company, decentralized shopping, decentralized cafe, all of this? That's super interesting, I think, again, for a lot of industries. And then our transportation habits have changed dramatically, and the trust in public transportation has really decreased. So this is, of course, bad. And another bad thing is also people are unfortunately choosing the car instead, because that's what we all heard, that taking a car is better. You can sit in your car and you can be protected. So more people are buying cars. But the third thing that then happened is that people are walking and biking so much more than they ever have. During all the years we have done public life studies in Copenhagen, we have never seen people walk and bike so much. And this is Copenhagen we're talking about. It's like people are just going all in for choosing that. That means also that, of course, there's a great potential for mobility disruptors to go in, creating new services, delivery apps, e-scooters, I mentioned it before. I mean, if they actually truly understand what the people in the specific city want and understand the culture and collaborate with the cities, I would say they have a tremendous chance to just go in and get the market share. Yeah, there's just new markets. And I think it's good also to challenge, especially other cities than Copenhagen. I mean, the public transportation is not working well in Los Angeles that we have looked in, for example. Maybe this is a chance that someone like start to challenge all of these old mobility patterns and understand that going back to this living organism again, it's made up of users, yes, but it's also citizens, it's governments, it's laws, it's culture, it's politics. There's so many parts. So I think if these companies could understand that or get a better understanding of it, being more people-centered, I have to say, as a Gale employee, and because I really believe it, I think you can really get far in understanding how, where, and why people move in the cities, and then create a better service.
What I see at the moment in organizations is a very strong need from people to interact with one another, for belonging, for connection, connecting with each other. And I was wondering, like, how can designing cities or designing companies help to respond to this need? Make it possible, if you stay local, to still be connected to others, to still identify with your team or your company. How can this be possible?
Well, that's a super interesting question. And I must say that this, to be honest, it was a challenge for Gale as well to start working digital. And our team was just sitting all over and, you know, with the delays and everything there is with using Zoom and Teams and so on. I think there's true challenges with how you can actually do this. But I also feel like, I think going back to this type of job or type of meeting you would have, I think there would be a combination of having these hubs that could be meeting spaces where you actually meet with your team, and then other places that could be for deeper work where you sit alone. Because I don't know how it is for you guys, but for me, it has actually been kind of interesting to get reminded how much I get done when I sit by myself sometimes. And I think it's kind of healthy, to be honest. We don't need to be like 40 hours a week together with the whole team, but we do need to meet with the team. That's another thing. But I think this supporting different kinds of work moods or modes, I think is kind of interesting to think about.
Inviting people for sustainable behavior. Do you have any idea how you can implement this to an organization?
To be able to do this inviting design, I think it's super, super important to have this kind of ethnographic approach or understanding what is actually missing or what would actually improve their everyday life. I think it's so basic process that I think it's really, really good and important to always remember. Because it's easier said than done, right? Because it always costs money if you need to do this. So many might cut it off unless the client pays for it, right? But I do think that it will always improve a design solution to have this understanding. We all have the responsibility to actually make it good for people, to make it more sustainable. So I would say that that's one of the most important parts. And then to collaborate more. I mean, I would say that this year has absolutely been a learning for me that we cannot do this alone. And I think we knew this from before. This is not rocket science, but I think we have all been very focused on economy and to have a good budget and to have a good baseline. And I think that's still important. But I think what's clear now is that I think we could actually, maybe long term, but we can actually get a better bottom line by actually working together and to create these consortiums and actually contribute with what we're good at instead of trying to employ all of these new people and we need someone that knows something about data and we need someone used with technology and building this up is so expensive for a company and it takes so much planning. And I think in this uncertain times, why not use each other? We're all in this together, so let's collaborate more.
Let's end up with the last question, the same question we use in every episode. When we talked before, you said there are quite a lot of dystopian scenarios that are connected to cities, and we're interested in maybe the opposite. So do you have a utopian scenario for cities in this world?
Well, I would say that a utopian idea of a city is how we can actually create this kind of open and green spaces for everyone, making it more inclusive, more democratic in that way, that if we can actually start to look at the space we're not using, especially after COVID, and also when coming to new mobility, that maybe we don't need to use as much space as we have done so far because maybe we can change mobility habits even more. I would say that would be fantastic for me to know that people living in very dense cities, also New York and bigger cities, that they all have access to green and open space. I think it's among the most important thing for people's life quality.
So Anna, what are your takeaways from this episode?
Well, first of all, I was really surprised by Liselotte saying that the future is local, because I would have thought that it's definitely going to be even more globalized. But of course, it makes totally sense. And I think the question is, what does that mean for organizations when designing workspaces, for example? So are we going to have local hubs in our area so I can just meet some colleagues there and still have the sense of belonging?
I also like the idea of being inviting rather than nudge people into some kind of behavior that they are not even fully aware of, and the importance of making the sustainable choice, the easy choice. I think this is also something organizations can take from this episode. And I was thinking about really small and simple things like providing lunch boxes in the entrance of your organization so people can just grab a box when they go out for lunch and avoid extra waste, for example.
Or just change the default mode when planning a meeting and not setting it up for 60 minutes, but 55 minutes, so you have a 5-minute break.
Yeah, so I think this is a lot about just changing the default option. I think still until today, many default options are the cheapest options. And I think in the future, it's really important to extend this criteria and let sustainable at least be on the same level or even be more important than the cheapest option.
And it's also a lot about changing habits, right? And trying to make it easy to establish habits that are healthier, more sustainable. And I think it also takes a bit the burden away from you that you always need to make the more ethical choice, even if it's a harder choice, because that might be a bit too hard and also too unrealistic, if we are honest.
Yeah, what I also took away from the conversation with Liselotte was that as soon as you want to change something in the system, in the city or an organization, there will be very strong forces who will try to protect the current state. And you have to be bold and you have to be strong in order to really make change happen.
I think what was also super interesting was this picture of the city as a living system, which of course we can also apply to organizations and to keep in mind that everything is connected and we can't just change single parts.
All right, thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, please share it with a friend and we see you next time.